Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The U.S. Senate last week voted to dismantle internet and technology privacy protections, sending the measure to the House, where concurrence is likely, and then to the president, who is expected to sign it into law. That means that telecom companies such as AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast can collect data on their customers' online activity and app usage without permission, and they could sell the data as well. New York Times reporter Cecilia Kang has written about the issue. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be here.
The rules were enacted last year by the Federal Communications Commission. What did the rules do?
Well, the rules had two major components. The first you already outlined, which essentially deals with your browsing and app activity history. An ISP, a broadband provider like AT&T or Comcast, would have to ask their customers permission first before collecting data on the websites you visit, the apps you use. So that means like even checking in the weather on your iPhone, checking websites for medical websites for potential illness. These are all things that are sensitive information that could not be tracked under these rules unless you as a company ask for permission first. The second part of the rules had to do with data security. The FCC required that these broadband providers take reasonable measures to ensure that your data was protected from hacking.
And that was part of this law that the U.S. Senate just voted on?
That it's all in the law.
So okay.
The Senate just voted to completely overturn those rules. And the House today at around 3 p.m. will also vote. They are very much expected to concur with the Senate's position, and the president is also expected to sign this into law. So this would be the first major rollback of a telecommunications or tech policy in this new administration.
It hadn't gone into effect yet. It wasn't scheduled to go into effect until 2018, right?
No, not until the end of this year.
At the end of this year, okay.
Correct.
What have the telecoms, or what were they going to be doing in the meantime anyways? Snooping and selling, or what?
Well, it was sort of status quo until these rules went into effect. But these companies, knowing that there was a careful eye on them, they're careful not to do anything that is particularly egregious in terms of data collection. But they were essentially free to collect data unless told not to. And depending on your own privacy policy as a company, they were regulated under general consumer protection laws that make sure that you follow what you say you'll do. If a customer signs a contract with you and the contract says we will not do X or Y, but the company does do X or Y, then that would have been a breach of that contract. It would have been deceit. And so those are the kinds of things that could protect consumers. And that's sort of what will be the guiding framework for protection going forward unless new rules are created, which in this administration is very unlikely to happen.
I'm asked all the time when it comes to signing up for apps whether I allow access to this or that, and I always usually, unless it affects the actual use of the app, I say no, right? But why do the big cable and telecom companies say that they should have unfettered access to this data where they don't even have to ask my permission?
Well, their argument, actually, and it is sort of a roundabout argument, it's actually sort of a very bureaucratic argument that the FCC should not be in the business of regulating privacy, the Federal Trade Commission should. It's a little bit, if you're a consumer and you're concerned about your data, it all sounds like gobbledygook, frankly,
yeah,
if you're outside of Washington. This is a big business for them. The truth of the matter is this is a lot of revenue opportunity to be able to collect and sell data to advertisers. The whole future going forward is customized targeting of advertising, particularly over mobile devices. All of these companies, this is the whole reason why AT&T is merging with Time Warner, and Verizon wants to buy Yahoo and other media properties. They want to do, and because these acquisitions mean more ability to collect information on what users are doing by keeping them within their universe of content and video streaming and et cetera. So this is where the future is. This is where the money is. And that said, the company say that, and this is an interesting argument, that they are just one of many companies in this whole internet ecosystem. And why should they have stricter rules than, say, a Google or a Facebook? Because mm-hmm. Google and Facebook owns a lot of the advertising market. And that actually is an interesting argument. If you're a consumer, you would say, I want strong protection from both. And so let's start with ISPs. But those are the kinds of arguments that the telecom companies make.
I'm going to just guess that the idea is that Facebook and Google I can choose to use, whereas I need my telecom company to provide my internet service.
Well, there's that. There is the fact that there is so little competition in most cities and towns for the number of providers. The options that you have for broadband, either wirelessly or through a wire to your home. So that's an argument that several Democratic lawmakers and regulators say make it particularly important to have strong privacy protections for ISPs. The other reason is a real fact artifact of the way that government is divided in terms of responsibilities. The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, simply does not regulate Google and Facebook and Netflix. It regulates communications carriers, and that includes AT&T and Comcast. So, you know, if there weren't those dividing lines, perhaps you'd see broader and more far-sweeping privacy rules, but that just doesn't exist.
And nothing exists to regulate Google and Facebook and Twitter.
The only thing that exists are general consumer protection laws. And that means that the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, they enforce, and this is not a regulatory agency. They're essentially mm-hmm. like a cop, mm-hmm. a federal cop. They enforce laws that ensure that, say, if you're Google and you promise I'm going to do A, B, and C, they enforce your promise to the consumer and make sure you carry it forward. That's what they do. So, in other words, the companies create their own voluntary privacy policies, these web companies like Google and Facebook. The FTC only enforces that, only makes sure that they carry through with those promises.
The rules were put in place by the Federal Communications Commission. Why is Congress working on the issue? Why couldn't the FCC, under new leadership that supports this change, reverse the rules?
The FCC could have, certainly. The reason why Congress did this, and it certainly appears to be a very effective approach, is they did this through a procedure called the Congressional Review Act. What that is a law that enables lawmakers, members of Congress, to overturn recently adopted agency rules. This is the idea behind this is sort of a checks and balance thing. Don't let the agencies get too powerful, do things too much. Let Congress have some sort of a counterweight just in case. The process is very swift and easy in the sense that you don't need as many votes as you do for some other bills. And and right now with the numbers as they are in the House and in the mm-hmm. Senate, that's why this resolution through the Congressional Review Act passed so easily in the Senate and will most certainly, as it appears, do so today in the House.
And there's no public hearings required too, right?
No, it's just there's a debate on the floor, mm-hmm. but it's not public. It's between the lawmakers and people get their points across. Democrats were certainly vocal on the Senate vote. They will today. They were yesterday on the House bill, and they're very active in their own statements against this. But there's no public way. And the thing that consumers could do is to call their vocal representatives to try to push back. But the numbers, particularly in the House, are overwhelmingly in favor of this.
Is this just a free trade kind of a philosophy that Republicans embrace on this score?
Definitely the mainstream Republican free market views are a big underlying theme in any of the promises to roll back these tech and telecom policies. The view is that government, if you're from Republican lawmakers, is that during the Obama administration, there are just too many rules that were created, particularly a rule that regulated, that classified internet service providers, broadband providers, as common carrier services. Common carrier services include the phone, and the phone is a heavily regulated service. When the Democratic-led FCC in the previous administration made that action, that was the prime example in the minds of Republicans of how government is overreaching in the creation of rules. They very much are pro free market. Let companies have more freedom to explore different business models and try different things. That's certainly one of the underlying principles involved in this action.
What else in that case can they overturn that definition set by the FCC that, you know, the Verizons of the world, AT&T, Comcast are common carriers? Can they change that?
They can. They cannot do it through the Congressional Review Act because the Congressional Review Act requires that the law has to be fairly recent. Mm-hmm. Since the privacy rules were adopted last October, it fit within the window to use that procedure. They can. I was just talking to a member of Congress, Marsha Blackburn, who actually introduced the broadband privacy resolution that will be voted on today. She's a Republican from Tennessee. And she's also the chairperson of a subcommittee in the House on telecom and tech policy. So she's pretty powerful in that world. So she was saying that she prefers for the FCC to write its own order to overturn the classification of broadband as a common carrier service. She's been coordinating quite a bit with the chairman of the FCC. His name is Ajit Pai. So I suspect that you'll see the FCC make that move first and Congress follow with some sort of show of support, either through some sort of legal show of support or, you know, just through expression of support.
Is there anything else tech privacy related that falls into that window of congressional review action?
No, this is a pretty comprehensive overturn.
Okay.
That's happening right now. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Cecilia King, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time today.
You're welcome.
That's Cecilia King. She's a reporter for The New York Times. We'll have post a link to her article that gets at the vote. The House is expected to vote today to concur with the U.S. Senate vote last week to dismantle internet and technology privacy protections. The president is expected to sign that. We'll be right back with more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last year, Twitter changed its user experience. Instead of the endless stream of new tweets as they occur, a new algorithm is curating the content of the feed in the hopes of making the service easier to use, apparently. Some protested the changes at first, but Twitter hopes the new feed will lead to new users and at some point profitability. Joining us now is tech writer for Slate, Will Oramus. Welcome back to the show, Will.
Thanks for having me in.
What do we know about how this algorithm works and how it actually changes Twitter users' feeds?
Well, until recently, we knew very little about how this algorithm works. Twitter gave me a first look at some of the basics of its workings, and that was really the first time they've spoken about it since they launched it a year ago. When they first came out with it, there was a huge backlash. People, most people don't use Twitter. Only about 20% of American adults use it regularly. But those who do, a lot of them just love it. I mean, they're addicted. And so whenever Twitter tries to change anything, often in an attempt to draw in some of those 80% who don't use it, the 20% have a tendency to get really, really mad. And so there was this whole hashtag campaign that went around when they launched it called RIP Twitter, with the implication being that this was going to absolutely kill Twitter and everybody would leave. In fact, that's not what happened. It's been a much more subtle change, and that's partly because Twitter didn't make the whole feed automated. They didn't let their algorithms choose the order of every tweet in your feed like Facebook does. Instead, they just picked a couple places up at the top of your feed where their machine learning algorithms will select some tweets for you to see first, and then the rest of your feed is still in chronological order, and it will still update live just the way it used to.
So RIP Twitter didn't kill Twitter, but did the algorithm that they employed help in the way they hoped?
Well, what they told me is that it actually has produced positive effects along every metric that they care about. So that means that more people who use Twitter already are spending more time on it. People who, in that time that they're spending, they're reading more tweets, favoriting more tweets, retweeting more. Not only that, but one thing that actually surprised Twitter's own engineers was that people started tweeting more. I mean, it's not an obvious thing that if you see automated tweets at the top of your feed, that would prompt you to craft more tweets. But that is apparently, in fact, what happened. So that's all the good news. The bad news is Twitter would not disclose to me by how much the algorithmic feed has improved these metrics, and it can't be that much because the company is still struggling financially. It is still, its user growth is still very slow. Its latest earnings report did not provide a big sign of major gains in these metrics. So Twitter still has a long way to go. It's still in trouble, but the algorithm is probably its best hope of changing the service in a way that over time can draw in more users, make it a more friendly experience that more people have interest in spending time on.
I have to say, I have been seeing a lot more ads on Twitter. Is that a function of all this?
No, that's actually separate. So both Twitter and Facebook have done something that's kind of interesting. They have followed what media organizations have done historically, which is to separate their advertising products from their, in media it's editorial, in social media it's the user-generated content. Mm-hmm. But both Facebook and Twitter have different algorithms for their ads, and they can tune those algorithms separately. So Twitter could show you more ads or fewer ads, but that's actually independent of the algorithm that it uses to sort the tweets that you see in your feed.
And how do they sort some tweets and not all of them?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of confusing, actually. So what they've done is they've put these automatically selected tweets into two different boxes, so to speak. One of them is called, they call it the ranked timeline. Probably nobody who uses Twitter knows it by that name. But that is the feature, the internal feature at Twitter, whereby when you log in to Twitter after some time away, the tweets you will now see at the top of your feed, it could be the first 5, could be the first 10, could be the first 15. It's all personalized based on your behavior. But those tweets will have been selected by Twitter's algorithm as maybe the tweets that it thinks you're most likely to find interesting from the time that you've been away from the app. But then once you've gone through those first 5, 10, 15 tweets, then the next tweet after that will just be the most recent one from anyone you follow, and from there on the feed is chronological. And then when you go to refresh the feed or when you update it, it will again be chronological, and you'll just be sort of back in the old real-time Twitter experience where the top of your feed is just whatever was tweeted most recently. That's the first form in which you see it. There's actually a second form called In Case You Missed It, which shows up under a different set of circumstances. We don't need to go into all the weeds, but that box can show up a little further down in your feed and include tweets from even longer ago than the ones that are in your ranked timeline.
This is creating, you write, the same news bubble that Facebook's been accused of creating with its algorithms, that where you're only seeing stuff like, if I retweet something, I may retweet it for a lot of reasons, but most people retweet because it's something they like, right?
Yeah, that's the risk here. So one thing that people have liked about Twitter as opposed to Facebook is you are in full control of the tweets you see in your feed. You get to choose who to follow, and then you see everything they tweet in chronological order. At least that's the way it's always been.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can still see all that stuff, but the more tweets that they select via algorithm to put at the top of your feed, the more it will become like Facebook, where Twitter's own data are determining which tweets you should see. And that's when you run the risk of what Eli Pariser called the filter bubble, which is the idea that sort of by your own behavior, by the stuff that you interact with in your feed, you are telling Twitter's algorithm or Facebook's algorithm that you like a certain type of content and not another type of content. And then it will feed you more of what it knows you already like. The danger there, in terms of, you know, to the extent that these social media feeds are now a source of news and a place for political discussion and debate, the danger is that in doing so, they're going to feed you more and more stuff that confirms your pre-existing biases. And that may mean if you're conservative, you just see more and more conservative stuff because their algorithm has found that you tend to like that stuff more. If you're liberal, vice versa, you'll see more and more liberal stuff. And so Twitter is aware of this problem. At least they tell me they're aware of this problem. And they said they're working to try to include some things in the algorithm that will make sure you see a sort of a diversity of content in your algorithmically selected tweets. But it's a hard thing, because if the algorithm is telling Twitter that you don't like that stuff, then it would seem like it's maybe against Twitter's business interests to give you content that challenges your preconceptions, and it would do better by giving you content that appeals to your preconceptions.
I was surprised to read that Twitter is not only doing that, but it's also popping in tweets from sources that I don't even follow.
Right. So the one interesting kind of behind the scenes thing about this algorithm is, as long as Twitter just ordered all your tweets chronologically, it had no way to sort of test hypotheses about which tweets you would rather see than others. But now with the algorithm, it can. So, if it thinks, well, maybe if we showed this person, maybe if we showed Anne more tweets from Will at the top of her feed, then she would engage more, and then that would be a good thing. Then it can try that out, and it'll put more tweets from me in your feed, and then it'll study your behavior for a few weeks and decide, actually, Anne hates seeing tweets from Will. Let's stop doing that. And so what it can now do is use that sort of data to predict what other tweets you might want to see, even from people you don't follow. So Twitter's implementation of this algorithm so far has been quite modest, which is that's both why the backlash has not really been sustained. People aren't really mad about this anymore. But at the same time, it hasn't really reversed Twitter's fortunes because they've done it in such modest form. I would expect to see, if Twitter continues to struggle in the months to come, I would expect to see them lean more heavily on this algorithm and Twitter become a little more like Facebook, where they're choosing which tweets you see.
Which is what a lot of people think is kind of a drag.
Yeah, I mean, a lot, people think it's a drag, and at the same time, Facebook is an enormously successful company,
right?
One of the most successful companies in the world. And so, nobody loves the fact that some faceless, servers in Menlo Park are choosing what stuff they see from their friends. But in practice, it works. it's going to make Twitter maybe less beloved, but possibly more popular.
Such an American thing. What has Donald Trump's use of Twitter meant for the company? Anything?
I think it has to mean something, but it's very hard to measure. In a way, this should be Twitter's time right now. You've got the most powerful person in the world basically addicted to Twitter, and he tweets, he tweets controversial stuff, explosive stuff, newsworthy stuff. But Twitter keeps running into the same problem it's always had, which is, important and powerful people use it. But for everybody else, you don't really need to use Twitter to see that stuff. I mean, Donald Trump's tweets are covered all over the news, and you don't need to be an active Twitter user in order to sort of get the benefit of his Twitter use. So the challenge for Twitter over the years has been, how do you turn that kind of impact that Twitter has into a sort of monetizable and large base of people who actually use the service? And it's still struggling with that. So, I mean, Donald Trump makes Twitter more relevant than ever, but he doesn't seem to have made it any more profitable than it was before.
I would have thought there would have been a curiosity factor, but there's certain one of the things that Twitter has a problem with is lots of people sign up for Twitter and then they sign off of it just as fast.
That's exactly right. That's its biggest problem. It's not that people don't try Twitter. It's that they try it and then they don't like it. Or, you know, they try it and they find it too much to keep up with. And a lot of the people who do use it on a regular basis are people who use it professionally because, you know, if you're a celebrity or a politician or a journalist, it's a way to reach your audience. And so you have a professional interest in doing it. But if you don't have a professional interest, it's just kind of a lot of work to keep up with. And that's one of the things that this algorithm is you know, they're hoping that this can help with because part of the problem has been you sign in and you're just dropped into the middle of 80 different conversations about 80 different things with no context. Their real challenge has been to figure out a way, especially for newer users, when you open up Twitter, you see a lot of really good, interesting stuff that stands on its own rather than just being dropped in to ongoing conversations that you have no context for.
Twitter acquired the video streaming app Periscope in 2015. And I was wondering if that caught on in any meaningful way. It seems like even a year ago, I was seeing a lot more video on Twitter than I am now.
Yeah. You know, Twitter is it's really a struggling company. It has this product that's a huge hit in some ways. But as a company, it's really been more or less dysfunctional from the beginning. It's had tons of turnover among its leadership. It has, you know, its product, it has innovated in its products, including with Vine, which was that, you know, that 6-second video app mm-hmm. that it recently closed. It shut down. Periscope was an innovation of Twitter. And what happens is it comes out with these innovations and then sort of bigger, better run companies like Facebook copy them and drive Twitter's product to the side just by their sheer scale and the quality of their execution. And so Periscope looks like it could be another example of that where Twitter sort of took the lead. It bought Periscope before anybody thought that sort of live video streaming to your friends would be a thing. And then Facebook quickly copied it and you know is in danger of crushing it.
How does advertising work on Twitter? How does a company, what are they buying?
That's part of Twitter's problem is that they haven't been able to clearly articulate to advertisers, you know, what it is they are buying or why they should advertise on Twitter. These days, online advertisers are largely after scale. They want to reach the largest number of people in their target demographic that they can. Twitter struggles with that because it only has a minority of users even on the service. What Twitter can do is it can give advertisers a chance to reach people not just in a certain demographic, but people who are talking about a certain topic at a certain time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the same way that advertisers on TV, if you're advertising on a show, you know what the person is doing when they see your ad. They're watching that show. They have interest in that show, and so you can reach a targeted audience in that way. Twitter can combine the demographic targeting of Facebook, where you can say, well, I want people who are generally interested in these topics and who are this age and this gender and live in this geographic region. It can potentially combine that with the kind of targeting you can do on TV, where you say, not only do I want to reach this subset of people, but I want to reach them while they are talking about, you know, the U.S. election, or while they're talking about the World Cup, or while they're watching the Super Bowl. It seems like it should be a pretty valuable proposition. In reality, advertisers say that they haven't seen a lot of conversion from their ads on Twitter, and that's part of why Twitter is struggling as a business.
When you say conversion, you mean people clicking on it?
Yeah, I mean, they just haven't. Yeah, I mean, there are various ways to measure the impact of advertising, and there's a cliche in the advertising business that you never know exactly what your ads are doing. So there is always a measurement problem, but there are various metrics you can use. You could use clicks, you could use the time a person spends looking at the tweet. You can use all sorts of different data to try to figure out what impact your ads are having. And so far, Twitter, you know, either the ads aren't working or Twitter hasn't found the right data to convince advertisers that they're working.
What's been the impact on all of this of like something like TweetDeck, where you can kind of, you know, do laser beam on the people you really care about watching and ignore really the larger feed anyway?
You know, so TweetDeck, which is an app that gives you a different way to use Twitter. You can sort of make lists and see different feeds all at once. It's kind of like this big dashboard of different kinds of tweets. Apps like that have not, as far as I know, had a substantial impact on Twitter's bottom line. The reason is that only is a very, you know, even among the minority of people who use Twitter, it is a small subset who use it heavily enough to use apps like TweetDeck. A lot of people think Twitter made a huge mistake years ago. When Twitter first started, it had an open API, which is it's a sort of a fancy way of saying that it gave anybody who wanted access to Twitter's data or wanted to build like apps or products that would draw on Twitter, Twitter would let them do that. Over the years, Twitter closed that off, and they made it much harder for like startup companies to build products on top of Twitter or build apps that use Twitter in fresh and exciting ways. A lot of people think that was a tremendous mistake. Twitter wanted more control over how people experience tweets, but what they ended up with was maybe a lot less innovation, maybe a lot of missed opportunities to use Twitter in fresh ways. So TweetDeck is it's something that people, you know, power users of Twitter really love it, but it's not used by enough people to really make a big difference to the company. The one way that Twitter is trying to change that, you know, because their advertising business is struggling, they're looking for new forms of revenue, and there was talk last week, there were some leaked surveys and slide decks that suggested Twitter might be trying to charge a subscription for an enhanced version of TweetDeck. This would be a way of getting a more sort of sustainable revenue stream from the people who use Twitter the most heavily. I think it's a smart idea. I don't know how much it will really affect Twitter's fortunes.
Right. So, you know, how long can Twitter survive?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I mean, it came relatively close to being bought by somebody last fall. Uh-huh. Twitter actually hired an investment bank to field offers, and several big tech companies considered it, including Salesforce looked at it, even Disney looked at it, apparently. And what turned them off, it's interesting, what turned them off were not the fundamentals of Twitter's business. You know, the appeal of Twitter for a buyer is that it has extremely rich data on its users and what they're interested in, what they're doing at any given point in the day. But the problem is Twitter because it has committed itself heavily to what it considers free speech and has done very little moderation or meddling in what people say on there, it has become a real a honeypot, to borrow a term used by a journalist at BuzzFeed. It's become a honeypot for trolls, basically. You know, it's a great place if you're sort of a mean-spirited person who wants to go and embarrass somebody publicly. Twitter is a great place to do that. And so there actually, word was that companies like Disney and Salesforce backed off of their bids on Twitter because they didn't want to take over this ugly problem of people doing hateful tweets and you know, Nazi tweets and racist tweets and sexual harassing tweets. They didn't want that to be their problem. They decided, we'll let Twitter keep that.
And that is another issue that Twitter's working on.
Yeah, they're working on it. They're finally working on it hard. I don't know if it's, you know, for the sort of moral reasons that people were calling on them to work on it over the years, or if it's because they have finally realized that it's an existential threat to their business. I mean, if you are a place where people do not feel safe, where they feel like they're going to be subjected to hate and harassment, that's not a place that most people want to spend their time.
Will Oremus, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time as always.
Thanks, Anna. I enjoyed it.
So Will Oremus, tech writer for Slate, will have a link to his article about Twitter and its algorithms and how they're working on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last year, tech company Samsung was forced to recall millions of their smartphones. Their Galaxy Note 7 phones had defective batteries that were causing fires. Now the company is planning to turn lemons into lemonade by offering refurbished Note 7s. Joining us now to discuss this and other tech news is contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So if the refurbished Galaxy Note 7s work as well as my refurbished toaster, I wouldn't want it. But anyways, give us a quick overview of the Galaxy Note 7 saga. When did Samsung realize they had a problem? What happened? And when did people finally, were they forced to give them up?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, this started not too long after the phone was released to the public and you were able to purchase them. There were a couple of people that had noticed some pretty significant problems with the Galaxy S7 doing things like burning a car down and causing some other problems. And, you know, this actually, it's weird to say this, but this happens every once in a while with every phone. So Samsung, you know, kind of was a little cautious at first instead of, you know, doing a giant recall. And there was some speculation based on an internal report that they did that said that it was just this one batch of phones that was causing this problem. And so they tried to kind of save face by pulling that one batch in and giving these other phones out. But it kept happening. There kept being problems where the battery would combust. Something was puncturing the battery and causing these fires. And so eventually Samsung didn't have a choice but to, you know, completely recall the line. They, you know, they asked everyone to return phones to carriers. And weirdly, a lot of people said no.
Yeah.
There was a significant group of people, you know, particularly here in the U.S., Verizon Wireless customers and T-Mobile customers, you know, after being told, you know, bring us your phone and we will gladly give you your money back or, you know, swap you out for another phone or, you know, something. However, you know, that arrangement was going to work out. They decided to keep them and continue using them. And while, you know, there were no more reports of phones exploding, it was enough of a problem that Samsung worked with each one of the carriers to release an update around the holiday season that completely disabled the phone so that it couldn't communicate with the wireless network. So if you put a SIM card in the phone, it just didn't connect to the network. You could only connect to Wi-Fi. And there are still some people who have these phones, and I don't know what they do with them now. There was, when Samsung identified the problem, they identified that it was, you know, definitively this battery that was causing the problem. And so if they were to replace the battery with something that was just slightly smaller and you know, fit in the spec that they needed, all of the other things about this phone would still be fine. And so the hope is that in places where the phone hasn't been completely banned by regulatory efforts and, you know, that they will be able to sell them as refurbished phones at a discounted price to try and make some of that money back, I guess.
Where has it been completely banned?
I know that the UK has completely banned it. There have been several other countries. The U.S. has banned it from sale in its current form, but there is kind of an appeal process for this refurbished thing that, if Samsung were to go through, it's possible that the phone could be sold in the U.S. again at some point in the future. But all of this is really kind of curious since, you know, the announcement came yesterday and 24 hours from right now, Samsung is going to be announcing a whole new phone that would in many ways replace this Note 7 as kind of the best phone that they sell.
The company, as we said, wants to refurbish some of these phones for resale. And you said, you know, they just put in smaller batteries, shouldn't be a problem. What's the advantage to getting one of those phones?
Well, the phone, you know, when they didn't blow up, was a really good phone. The camera was exceptional. The screen was really good. It was a solid phone as far as, you know, what it was able to do at its time. Was able to compete in a lot of places, you know, where people still needed, you know, kind of that really big display to do things, you know, kind of as a replacement, almost as to a laptop in many cases, just because of the size of the screen and the ability to kind of use it.
Yeah, but that was a function of the battery too, wasn't it?
Battery, yeah. I mean, you know, being able to keep it charged was definitely a feature. And, you know, not blowing up is usually also a feature. So
I can't help but keep laughing.
It's really hard to look at this phone and go, yeah, but remember the part where they blew up.
Well, do the airlines remember it? I mean, the last time I flew was around the holidays, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's not something that you hear at airlines anymore because they've been disabled everywhere.
Yeah.
So, they're not something. But, yeah, I suspect that in order to be allowed in places like airlines or, things like that, that there's going to have to be some pretty significant changes to how this phone functions. Samsung's going to have to demonstrate in a lot of places that this phone is not dangerous. And it just, I am certainly not a large company, but it just doesn't seem worth the effort to me.
This next version of the phone, the Galaxy Note 8, what do we know about it? When it'll be released? You said they just announced, was it yesterday or today?
Oh, they're going to announce it tomorrow.
Okay, tomorrow.
The Galaxy S8 is going to be announced tomorrow. And a lot of the rumors surrounding the phone have suggested that it's going to be a kind of a new shape, basically.
Hmm.
Instead of the kind of rounded rectangle that we see right now, it's actually going to be a great deal taller instead of wider. And that's going to be kind of new and interesting because Samsung has focused really hard in the last couple of years on kind of removing as much space as possible on the front of the phone that isn't dedicated to showing you the display.
Mm-hmm.
And that has received a lot of criticism in the past for, dropping the phone and potentially breaking it. But a lot of what we have heard so far suggests that Samsung has done a lot to address that. So it's entirely possible that what we will see tomorrow is a phone that almost doesn't look like it has anything other than a display on the front of it. And that'll be really kind of interesting.
I suppose after the exploding phones saga, they've really had to up their game. Has Samsung's reputation been hurt by this whole thing? The holdouts notwithstanding, how's Samsung doing?
The reputation has not suffered as much as one would think. It certainly surprised me that the reputation had not really suffered. From this, there, still a lot of brand loyalty here. Samsung, very much got in front of the concerns with the battery back in January and produced this incredibly detailed report about what it is they found that was wrong with the battery and all of the steps that they have gone through to make sure that this doesn't happen again. As unfortunate as what happened with the Note 7 is, it's entirely possible and likely in this case that the Galaxy S8 is going to be the safest phone that they've ever made.
Right. How about, will people be paying out the nose for it or what?
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. If history is any indicator, this will be priced almost exactly the same as what you would get for a brand new iPhone when it comes out. So right around $700-$800 for, kind of the newest version.
Hmm. All righty. In other smartphone news, Motorola has a new budget-friendly phone that's getting pretty good reviews. Tell us about the Moto G5 Plus.
Yeah, the Moto G series has always been, kind of the budget version of Motorola's flagship phone. And what they've done is, put a smaller, less capable processor in there, a slightly less capable camera. But usually the same kind of battery. And so what you get is a phone that can run, a couple of apps really well and can take pretty decent pictures, but not, like the best pictures that you would get. But a battery that'll frequently last for multiple days without having any problems. And, in most cases, Motorola is able to keep the prices for these phones either at $300 or well under $300, which is just considerably less expensive than you would get for a new Samsung or a new Apple phone.
It uses a USB-C plug. We talked a little bit. I'm sorry. Last week, we talked a little bit about USB-C plugs, and this one uses a USB micro port for charging. What's the difference again, and is that a drawback?
So micro USB is what you'll see in most phones right now, where mm-hmm. it's got that, slightly odd shape to it that you plug into. And not moving to USB Type-C was probably a cost thing. It was cheaper to get a hold of these other parts that are kind of more of a standard right now. And so, I don't think that this will be a concern for people who are, only looking to spend $200 to $300 on a phone. They just kind of just want something that works. And then this, will absolutely be that.
How about the battery life?
The battery life, excuse me, the battery life so far on this has promised to deliver at least one full day of battery, and that's, you know, someone crazy like me using, you know, using the phone a whole lot. And, you know, with the previous generation, it, you know, a lot of people are able to get 2 to 3 days worth of battery out of it.
And the camera, any good?
The camera is pretty decent in most situations. It's not going to handle, you know, like a darkened room particularly well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, anyone who's looking to take a picture outdoors or in a room that's, you know, pretty well lit is going to be happy with the kind of pictures that they get.
You know, it's hard to think about someone that costs something that costs $300 or maybe, you know, around $300 is a bargain on in it, you know, for most people. Who are you recommending this phone for?
Really, this is, you know, this is a great kind of first phone for kids or someone who is being, you know, particularly budget conscious about, you know, having a phone, but still want something that, you know, will deliver the best possible experience. This is a phone for someone who isn't going to walk into a carrier store and say, you know, I'm willing to sign up for a contract if you give me a free phone. But at the same time, you know, wants to be a little more reasonable with how much they're spending.
And in Apple phone news, the iPhone isn't going to be necessarily new, but it's going to have a new outfit.
It's red. It started coming out this Friday. It is, you know, Apple has done this thing for a while where they've, you know, they've released a product and then they've done what they call a product red version. And it's this really kind of fire engine red. And every single time it comes out, you know, a product red version of something comes out, people get really, really excited about it. You know, both because they, you know, they stand out every single time, you know, something like this happens, they stand out, but also, you know, Apple takes a portion of the proceeds and puts it towards this product red, brand, that helps, raise awareness and produce funds for HIV and AIDS in, countries in Africa.
Okay. That's important. Besides the color, that's it, right?
Yeah, there's nothing functionally different about this phone. It is just very aggressively red.
I like those kind of bright things because things get lost in my purse if I don't use them that way. But
I love colorful phones,
yeah.
Especially, you know, any kind of, you know, colorful hardware like that. And Apple had been kind of shying away from it for a really long time where they, you know, they just kind of did the flat silver. And then people got really excited about the idea of there being a pinkish rose gold phone. And so I think Apple, you know, saw the popularity of that and decided to see how far they could get with this. And it's really, you know, the pictures that you see just don't do it justice how just strikingly red this thing is. You see it in a store. If you wander past an Apple store anytime soon, you should go check it out just to see how impressively red this phone is.
I will. But, you know, by the way, when you say that they're donating, you know, a portion of the proceeds to AIDS awareness and so forth in Africa, are consumers actually paying for that or is Apple paying for that?
There's nothing additional added to the cost.
Okay.
This is definitely comes out of Apple's bottom line and has forever.
Okay. Well, that's pretty cool. Speaking of charitable giving in the tech industry, Microsoft is working to bring the Xbox into children's hospitals. This is pretty cool.
Yeah, this is the coolest thing that I've seen so far. Microsoft is working with a company called the Gamers Outreach Foundation. They work with children's hospitals. And this is basically a medical cart. That they call them go-karts. And they have everything that a kid would need to play Xbox games entirely contained on the cart. So that nurses can you know wheel these carts in. Some of them are even battery powered, so they don't get in the way of any medical equipment. If something happens and the child needs to be addressed medically in kind of an emergency fashion, the cart can be very easily pushed out of the way. So they're safe for the staff that are working there, and they allow the kids to have some fun in situations where they're normally not able to.
And having fun helps kids get better a lot of times, or at least feel
Absolutely.
Better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Super cool. Well, Russell Holley, thanks for your time today. Lots of cool stuff.
It's been a pleasure.
Russell Holley, contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com. That is it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks to the Allsides staff. Producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shyla Knott, Allsides intern Sarah Stacy, Kyle McKinnon, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Thanks a lot for listening today. This is Allsides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.